This is Paula. Today I'm going to be reading a variety of articles for you from the Christian Science Monitor, dated Tuesday, February the 17th, 2026. As usual, I'm going to start in the world section of today's Monitor, and we're going to go through as many sections and articles as we can in the time that we have. So, to get us off to a good start, our first headline from today's world section reads, Japan makes history in Paris figure skating. So do many Russian-born skaters. On the figure skating Paris medal podium Monday evening, Japan won its first gold and set a world record. The other half of the six skaters standing before the crowd with medals around their necks were Russian-born. The date on this article is February the 17th. It is by Story Hinckley, who is a staff writer at the Monitor, and the dateline is Milan. When Anastasia Metelkin and Luka Berulava stepped on the podium at the Milan Ice Skating Arena Monday night to bow in their matching bedazzled teal as silver medals were hung around their necks, they made history. They had won Georgia's first-ever Olympic Winter Games medal with a little help from its neighbor. Russia is banned from competing as a country at the 2026 Milan Cortina Olympics, but the Milan Ice Skating Arena, the longtime figure skating force, but in the Milan Ice Skating Arena, the longtime figure skating force is about as inconspicuous as a great Russian bear. On the figure skating pair's medal podium Monday evening, half of the six skaters standing before the crowd with medals around their necks were Russian-born athletes. The gold medal went to Japan's Riku Miura and Ryuichi Kihara, who had a world record-breaking free skate score and finished 10 points ahead. Silver went to the Georgian pair, Ms. Medelinkin and Mr. Berulava, both Russian-born skaters who trained in Perm, Russia, with Russian coaches. And the bronze went to the Germans, Minerva Fabienne Haas, born in Berlin, and her partner Nikita Volodin, a newly minted German citizen. I was accepted very well by the Georgians, and I want to do my very best to represent this flag and country, said Ms. Metelkina earlier this week. Between the doping scandals and the 2014 Sochi Olympics and its continued war in Ukraine, Russia has been banned from competing under its flag since the 2018 Pyeongchang Winter Games. Some of its athletes have chosen to compete as individual neutral athletes, or athlete individuel neutrel, AIN, the carryover name from the 2024 Paris Olympic Games. But in figure skating, more of the Russian-born athletes have chosen to compete for other countries. This is particularly true in the pair skating event, which Russia has historically dominated, winning gold in 13 out of the past 16 Winter Games, with plenty of silver and bronze medals to boot. There are no AIN figure skating pairs competing in the Milan Cortina Games. Instead, 11 Russian-born skaters are competing for Armenia, Australia, France, Georgia, Germany, Hungary, the Netherlands, and Poland. The tentacles of Russia's deep history with figure skating extend through the arena in other ways. Russian coaches hover at the edge of the rink. All three American skaters competing in the male individual events, Ilya Malinin, Andrew Sergachev and Maxim Naumov, are children of former professional skaters either born in Russia or who represented the country in competition. Adelia Petrosian, the sole female individual AIN skater, is Russia's best bet for the first AIN medal of the games later this week. This has led to some record-breaking appearances in Milan, with Russian-born skaters helming the first pairs teams from Armenia and the Netherlands, for example. The Russian-born Hungarian pair, who came in fourth and split their time between Sochi and Budapest, gave the country its first appearance in the event in 70 years. I feel cool because I am the first pair skater from Armenia, Karina Akop Kvitova, who competed for Russia with her partner Nikita Rachmanin before switching to represent Armenia in 2025, tells the Monitor after her short program. The whole country says thank you for skating and improving the sport in our country. So, how common is country switching among Olympic athletes? Country switching isn't uncommon in Olympic competitions, especially for athletes from winter sports powerhouses who have to compete for quota spots against some of the best athletes in their sport. Think alpine skier Sarah Schlepper, who represented the U.S. at four Olympics in the early 2000s before retiring and then coming back to ski for Mexico. In pair skating, country switching has long been necessary regardless of Olympic quotas, as finding the right partner with the right chemistry and skill set can sometimes require an international search. Russian-born skater Lulia Chechenina, for example, obtained Hungarian citizenship in 2020 to compete with her then partner. At the time, she commented that it was her third citizenship since she grew up in Switzerland. Then, in 2025, she applied for and was granted Polish citizenship to compete in the Olympics with her Polish partner. Athletes must be a national of a country to represent it in the Olympics, according to the International Olympic Committee, or IOC. This can lead to paperwork scrambles ahead of the games, given that only one of the partners must be a citizen to compete for a country in international skating union competitions. The top U.S. pair, Boston-based Alisa Efimova and Misha Mitrofanov, ranked sixth in the world, were unable to compete in Milan because Ms. Efimova, who was born in Finland and has represented both Russia and Germany in international competitions, did not obtain her U.S. citizenship in time. The whole situation left the pair, who are also married, with some kind of hunger to make the 2030 U.S. Olympic team, Ms. Efimova told the Associated Press. If we make it in 4 years to the Olympics, I think it would be even more valuable, even more precious. There are also murmurs here in Italy that Russia could soon be welcomed back. In her opening speech ahead of the Games, IOC President Kirsty Coventry, spoke about how, quote, our game is sport, not politics. And late last year, the IOC recommended that youth athletes with a Russian or Belarusian passport should no longer be restricted in their access to competitions in both individual and team sports. So how long has Russia been banned from the Games? Russia was first banned from the 2018, 2021, and 2022 Olympic Games following an IOC investigation into the country's systematic manipulation of the anti-doping system during the 2014 Sochi Olympics, which Russia denies. Individual athletes continued to compete under the title Olympic Athletes from Russia, OAR, and later Russian Olympic Committee, ROC. The doping ban was set to expire in December 2022, clearing the way for the country's comeback in Paris in 2024. But days after the 2022 closing ceremony in Beijing, Russian tanks rolled into Ukraine, a violation, says the IOC, of the Olympic truce, which calls for a halt to hostilities 1 week before the opening ceremonies and ends 1 week after the closing of the Paralympic Games. As with the 2024 Paris Games, individual athletes from Russia and Belarus, a nation that supports Russia's war against Ukraine, may compete as AIN athletes, but with stipulations. Only individuals can compete under AIN, meaning there are no Russian hockey players or curlers here in Italy. And it is up to the international federations in each sport to decide whether AIN athletes may compete. Some federations, such as those that oversee bobsled and biathlon, banned AIN athletes outright ahead of the 2026 Winter Games. The Skating Federation permitted AIN participation, while Russia rebutted and ultimately won an overturn of the bans imposed by the Luge and Skiing and Snowboarding Federations. Permitted athletes must pass a screening process where the IOC reviews athletes' social media to confirm they have not been tied to the war or vocally supportive of Russia's war against Ukraine. Russia's cross-country skiing gold medalist, Alexander Bolshunov, for example, was barred from competing because he participated in a pro-war rally in 2022 and is a captain in the Russian army. In addition, Russian or Belarusian athletes have a narrower qualification window within their sports. In figure skating, Russian and Belarusian skaters were given one opportunity to qualify for the games, but no pair skaters or ice dancing couples were permitted to compete at the Beijing qualifier. In the end, the IOC granted only three single skaters, Ms. Petrovsian, Victoria Safanova from Belarus, and Pyotr Gumenik from Russia, AIN participation status at Milan. Altogether, 20 AIN athletes, 13 from Russia and 7 from Belarus, are competing at this year's games across skiing, skating, luge, and ski mountaineering events. With less than a week to go in the Milan 2026 Milan Cortina Games, no AIN athlete has yet to win a medal. But the best chance could come from Ms. Petrosian. Although Ms. Petrosian has been banned from international skating union competitions for the past few years, the 18-year-old has won three consecutive Russian figure skating championships in 24, 25, and 26. And she plays first in the Beijing qualifier. She is known for landing triple axels, and in 2022, Ms. Petrosian became the first female skater to land a quadruple loop in competition. Her test will come later this week. At the Milan skating rink Monday evening, Mr. Perulava, holding his new silver medal while speaking with reporters after the medal ceremony, has, quote, no words to describe his victory. He has said Georgian is his first language. Mr. Perulava, who was born in Moscow to Georgian parents fleeing war in their home country, still has family in Georgia and an apartment in Tbilisi. But when asked by the monitor how it feels to win a medal for Georgia, he pauses and then asks, can I answer in Russian? So again, this particular article is by Story Hinckley, who is a staff writer at the monitor. Moving on to our second headline from today's World section of the Monitor. This one reads, Israel will begin West Bank land registration in new step to deepen control. Israel's cabinet approved a plan for a land registration process in the occupied West Bank that critics say amounts to a land grab from Palestinians. The date on this article is February the 16th. It is by Melanie Lidman of the Associated Press, and the dateline is Tel Aviv, Israel. Israel will begin a contentious land regulation process in a large part of the occupied West Bank, which could result in Israel gaining control over wide swaths of the area for future development, according to a government decision on Sunday. It paves the way for the resumption of settlement of land title processes, which had been frozen in the West Bank since the Mideast War in 1967. It means that when Israel begins the land registration process for a certain area, anyone with a claim to the land must submit documents proving ownership. Peace Now, the Israeli anti-settlement group, said the process likely amounts to a mega land grab from Palestinians. This move is very dramatic and allows the state to gain control of almost all of Area C, said Hagit Ofran, the director of Peace Now's Settlement Watch program. Area C refers to the 60% of the West Bank that is under full Israeli military control, according to agreements reached in the 1990s with the Palestinians. Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas's office, in a statement, called the decision a grave escalation and a flagrant violation of international law, which amounts to de facto annexation. It called on the international community, especially the UN Security Council and the United States, to intervene immediately. The decision is the latest step to deepen Israeli control over the West Bank. In recent months, Israel has greatly expanded construction in Jewish settlements, legalized outposts, and made significant bureaucratic changes to its policies in the territory to strengthen its hold and weaken the Palestinian Authority. Israel's foreign ministry said Palestinian Authority civil planning maps show that the authority has been advancing land registration procedures in Area C for years in violation of agreements that give Israel civil and military control over the area. It said Sunday its decision was made for greater transparency. The decision was first announced last May, but required further development before it was approved in this week's cabinet meeting. Under the decision, Israeli authorities will designate certain areas for registration, forcing anyone with a claim to the land to prove their ownership. Ms. Ofran said the process for providing ownership can be draconian and is rarely transparent, meaning any land that undergoes the registration process in areas currently owned by Palestinians is likely to revert to Israeli state control. Palestinians will be sent to prove ownership in a way that they will never be able to do, Ms. Ofran told the Associated Press. And this way, Israel might take over 83% of Area C, which is about half of the West Bank. The registration process could start as soon as this year, she said. The proposal has been put forward by some of Israel's far-right members of the ruling coalition, including the Minister of Justice, Yariv Levin. The government of Israel is committed to strengthening its grips on all its parts, and this decision is an expression of that commitment, he said. Jordan's foreign ministry, in a statement, called on the international community to assume its legal and moral responsibilities and to compel Israel, the occupying power, to stop its dangerous escalation. Qatar's foreign ministry said it considered Israel's decision an extension of its illegal plans to deprive the Palestinian people of their rights. Previous U.S. administrations have sharply condemned an expansion of Israeli activity and control in the West Bank, but Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has a particularly close relationship with President Donald Trump. The two met last week in Washington, their seventh meeting in the past year. And yet, Mr. Trump has opposed annexation, Ms. Ofran noted. Palestinians are not permitted to sell land privately to Israelis, though measures announced last week aim to nullify this. Currently, settlers can buy homes on land controlled by Israel's government. Last week's decision also aimed to expand Israeli enforcement of several aspects in the West Bank, including environmental and archaeological matters in Palestinian-administered areas. More than 700,000 Israelis live in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem, territories captured by Israel in 1967 from Jordan and sought by the Palestinians for a future state. The international community overwhelmingly considers Israeli settlement construction in these areas to be illegal and an obstacle to peace. Over 300,000 Palestinians are estimated to live in Area C of the West Bank, with many more in surrounding communities dependent on its agricultural and grazing lands, including plots for which families retain land deeds or tax records dating back decades. And a note here, Associated Press reporter Arij Hasboum in Jerusalem contributed to this report, which was written by Melanie Lidman, all of the Associated Press. With that, we're going to move on to the USA section because there are a number of articles that I'd like to get to today. So our first headline from the USA section reads, "In Cuba, is Trump seeking ouster of communist leaders or of China's presence?" Deteriorating conditions in a Cuba cut off from Venezuelan oil are feeding a debate in Washington. Regime change or a deal? Experts say the latter is more likely, while a bigger strategic goal might be to curb China's presence on the island. The date on this article is February the 17th. It is by Howard LaFranchi, who is a staff writer at The Monitor, and the dateline is Washington, D.C. With ousted Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro in custody in New York and his decapitated regime in Caracas quietly cooperating with the United States, President Donald Trump has shifted his hostile refrain to Cuba. "Cuba is a failing nation," Mr. Trump has been saying recently. "It is down for the count." And with the Trump administration severing of Cuba's Venezuelan oil lifeline and a January 29th executive order threatening stiff tariffs on any country supplying the island nation with oil, that assessment looks increasingly accurate. The oil blockade has quickly led Cuba to enact harsh measures, including a halt to all public transportation, the declaration of a four-day work week, the closure of the tourist hotels that provide much-needed revenue, and mounting blackouts. Families already enduring harsh living conditions are turning to wood and coal for cooking. Some international airlines have canceled their flights to the island. The rapidly deteriorating conditions in Cuba are feeding an intensifying debate in Washington: deal or regime change? Should Mr. Trump go for a Venezuelan-type bargain that leaves a cooperative segment of the existing government in place, or should he squeeze until he brings down a communist regime that has been a U.S. bête noire since 1959? The president's rhetoric might suggest he favors the latter. Accordingly, some Cuban Americans have become suddenly rhapsodic over the prospects of an imminent return to rebuild a democratic and capitalist homeland and perhaps reclaim properties they left behind some seven decades ago. Yet, anyone hoping for quick regime change in Havana is likely in for a disappointment, many regional experts say. Instead, most expect to see unrelenting U.S. economic pressure leading to some kind of agreement between the Trump administration and Cuban power brokers that favors gradual change on the island over sudden collapse and chaos. Such a deal might be negotiated with the Cuban government. But for some former U.S. officials and experts, it's more likely that meaningful talks would be, and if swirling rumors are correct, already are, held with other powerful circles. Among the candidates, senior military leaders who have long held a tight grip on the economy, or retired decision makers, including Raul Castro, the former president and late revolutionary leader Fidel Castro's nonagenarian brother. Trump says we are talking to the highest people in Cuba to get a deal, and that may or may not be true, says Michael Rubin, a senior fellow in foreign policy at the American Enterprise Institute in Washington. But what we do know is that if we are talking to any real decision makers, then it is not with the current president, Miguel Diaz-Canel, who is a mere figurehead, he adds. It would have to be someone or a group that matters. Dr. Rubin says that could be with what he calls the Troika, three aging former leaders led by Mr. Castro, or government officials who accept that a deal with the United States is inevitable, or with powerful military leaders willing to compromise with the U.S. to keep their share of the economy. Still, any discussion of a real deal raises the question. In the case of Cuba, what is President Trump looking for? Whereas the major strategic U.S. gets in Venezuela were access to the country's oil and cutting it off from adversaries, what the Trump administration might be going for in Cuba is ouster, not of the regime, some experts say, but of China. The more strategic goal here is getting China, but also Russia, away from using Cuba as a forward operating base for their intelligence and even military activities, says Christopher Hernandez-Roy, deputy director of the Americas program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. That goal, he notes, is 100% in line with the recent national security strategy that zeroes in on removing China from strategic locations in the Western Hemisphere. Trump is talking a lot about Greenland and earlier about the Panama Canal and other places in the hemisphere, he adds, but there is no more strategic location than 90 miles off the Florida Keys. The Cuban government insists that China has no intelligence gathering infrastructure on the island, but numerous U.S. government and national security think tank reports over recent years have asserted that such spy bases indeed exist, as they do in other Latin American countries with close ties to China. In the debate over deal versus regime change, many experts and some officials willing to speak under condition of anonymity say the wild card in deciding which option will prevail is Secretary of State Marco Rubio, who was born in Miami to Cuban parents. Mr. Rubio's standing with President Trump has vaulted even higher in recent months, and he has long advocated as a Florida senator and as a political darling of the South Florida Cuban exile community, a policy aimed at ridding Cuba of the revolution that prompted so many Cubans to leave their homeland. For its part, the Cuban government says that while it is open to talks with the U.S. that are respectful of Cuba's sovereignty, none are currently underway. Yet some experts caution that as much as the exile community and some of the president's close associates could be pressing for regime change, Mr. Trump might be better served by considering the potential ramifications of moving in that direction and by hewing closer to a Venezuela model of action. Bringing about regime change in Cuba has been the great white whale for many conservatives for a very long time, says Rosemary Kalanick, an expert in energy security and U.S. grand strategy at Defense Priorities, a Washington think tank advocating a realist foreign policy. This seems especially true in the South Florida Cuban community and in Trump's circle of friends at Mar-a-Lago. But while Trump is using oil to increase the pressure on the Cuban regime, she adds, I think the Venezuela model and Trump's talk of a deal suggest he could have something other than full regime change in mind. Dr. Kalanick said unrelenting pressure on Cuba risks destabilizing it and causing a humanitarian disaster just 90 miles off the Florida coast. The consequences could include refugee outflows from Cuba into Florida, she adds, so there's a real risk of blowback affecting an issue this administration cares about deeply. Forcing regime change would require deploying the Marines to Cuba's beaches, and that just isn't in the cards for a president who is not in favor of boots-on-the-ground options, said Mr. Hernandez-Roy. Instead, he foresees what he calls regime management that employs economic pressure to nudge gradual political change. Unlike Venezuela, Cuba has no democratic muscle memory to assist with quick political change, he says. As for who the Trump administration might turn to for meaningful talks, Mr. Hernandez-Roy says to keep an eye on Raul Castro's son, Alejandro Castro Espin, who was the Obama administration's behind-the-scenes interlocutor over normalizing of U.S.-Cuban relations. Dr. Rubin notes that more than 2 million Cubans have fled the island in recent years, many of them professionals and members of the middle class, driven out by economic collapse. He says that group might be encouraged to return and participate in Cuba's political and economic restructuring. In terms of what Mr. Trump might want from any negotiations with Cuba, Dr. Rubin advises keeping in mind that the president is a real estate dealmaker who relishes the idea of accomplishing what other presidents couldn't. Especially appealing to Mr. Trump, he says, would be putting hotels carrying his name on Cuba's beaches. Those signs would be a constant reminder that while Cuba's communist government stymied 12 U.S. presidents, it was President Trump who finally defeated it. And again, this particular article was by Howard LaFranchi, who is a staff writer at The Monitor. Moving on to our second headline from today's USA section of The Monitor, this one reads, U.S. military boards another oil tanker in Indian Ocean, tracked from Caribbean. U.S. military boarded a sanctioned tanker in the Indian Ocean after tracking it from the Caribbean Sea to target illicit oil connected to Venezuela. The date on this article is February the 16th. It is by Ben Finley of the Associated Press, and the dateline is Washington, D.C. U.S. military forces boarded another sanctioned tanker in the Indian Ocean after tracking the vessel from the Caribbean Sea in an effort to target illicit oil connected to Venezuela, the Pentagon said Sunday. Venezuela had faced U.S. sanctions on its oil for several years, relying on a shadow fleet of falsely flagged tankers to smuggle crude into global supply chains. President Donald Trump ordered a quarantine of sanctioned tankers in December to pressure then-President Nicolas Maduro before Mr. Maduro was apprehended in January during an American military operation. Several tankers fled the Venezuelan coast in the wake of the raid, including the ship that was boarded in the Indian Ocean overnight. The Defense Department said in a post on X that U.S. forces boarded the Veronica III, conducting a right of visit, maritime interdiction, and boarding. The vessel tried to defy President Trump's quarantine, hoping to slip away, the Pentagon said. We tracked it from the Caribbean to the Indian Ocean, closed the distance, and shut it down. Video posted by the Pentagon shows U.S. troops boarding the tanker. The Veronica III is a Panamanian-flagged vessel under U.S. sanctions related to Iran, according to the Treasury Department's Office of Foreign Assets Control website. The Panama Maritime Authority said on Sunday in a brief statement that the ship was no longer registered there and had been canceled in December 2024. The Veronica III left Venezuela on January 3rd, the same day as Mr. Maduro's capture, with nearly 2 million barrels of crude and fuel oil, tankertrackers.com posted on X on Sunday. Since 2023, she's been involved with Russian, Iranian, and Venezuelan oil, the organization said. Samir Madani, co-founder of tankertrackers.com, told the Associated Press in January that his organization used satellite imagery and surface-level photos to document that at least 16 tankers left the Venezuelan coast in contravention of the quarantine. The Trump administration has been seizing tankers as part of its broader efforts to take control of Venezuela's oil. The Pentagon did not say in the post whether the Veronica III was formally seized and placed under U.S. control, and it later told the AP in an email that it had no additional information to provide beyond the post. Last week, the U.S. military boarded a different tanker in the Indian Ocean, the Aquila II. The ship was being held while its ultimate fate was decided by the United States, according to a defense official who spoke last week on condition of anonymity to discuss ongoing decision-making. And a note here, Associated Press writers Constantine Toropin in Washington and Alma Solis in Panama City contributed to this report, which was written by Ben Findlay, also of the Associated Press. Still in the USA section of today's Monitor, the next headline reads, Rubio's speech to European allies takes a softer tone but keeps firm stance. Secretary of State Marco Rubio struck a less aggressive tone with allies about the Trump administration's intent to reshape the transatlantic alliance. The date on this article is February the 14th. It is by Matthew Lee, Emma Burrows, and Geir Molson of the Associated Press, and the dateline is Munich, Germany. U.S. Secretary of State Marco Rubio offered a reassuring message to America's allies on Saturday, striking a less aggressive but still firm tone about the administration's intent to reshape the transatlantic alliance and push its priorities after more than a year of President Donald Trump's often hostile rhetoric toward traditional allies. Reminding his audience at the annual Munich Security Conference about America's centuries-long roots in Europe, Secretary Rubio said the United States would remain forever tied to the continent, even as it pushes for changes in the relationship and the institutions that have been the bulwark of the post-World War II world order. Mr. Rubio addressed the conference a year after Vice President J.D. Vance stunned the same audience with a harsh critique of European values. A series of Trump administration statements and moves targeting allies followed, including President Trump's short-lived threat last month to impose new tariffs on several European countries in a bid to secure U.S. control of Greenland, a semi-autonomous territory of NATO-allied Denmark. On Friday, German Chancellor Friedrich Merz had opened this year's gathering by calling for the U.S. and Europe to repair and revive transatlantic trust together, saying that even the U.S. isn't powerful enough to go it alone in a world whose old order no longer exists. But he and other European officials made clear that they will stand by their values, including their approach to free speech, climate change, and free trade. While offering a calmer and more reassuring tone, Mr. Rubio made clear that the Trump administration is sticking to its guns on policy. He denounced a climate cult and an unprecedented wave of mass migration that threatens the cohesion of our societies. Secretary Rubio argued that the euphoria of the Western victory in the Cold War led to a dangerous delusion that we had entered the end of history, that every nation would now be a liberal democracy, that the ties formed by trade and by commerce alone would now replace nationhood, and that we would now live in a world without borders where everyone became a citizen of the world. We made these mistakes together, and now together we owe it to our people to face those facts and to move forward to rebuild, Mr. Rubio said. This is why we Americans may sometimes come off as a little direct and urgent in our counsel, he said. This is why President Trump demands seriousness and reciprocity from our friends here in Europe. Secretary Rubio said that the end of the transatlantic era is neither our goal nor our wish, adding that our home may be in the Western Hemisphere, but we will always be a child of Europe. He acknowledged that we have bled and died side by side on battlefields from Kapyong to Kandahar, a contrast with disparaging remarks by Trump about NATO's allies' troops in Afghanistan that drew an outcry. And I'm here today to make it clear that America is charting the path for a new century of prosperity, and that once again we want to do it together with you, our cherished allies and our oldest friends. U.S. officials accompanying Mr. Rubio said his message was much the same as Mr. Vance's last year, but was intended to have a softer landing on the audience, which they acknowledged had recoiled at much of President Trump's rhetoric over the past year. The president of the European Union's Executive Commission, Ursula von der Leyen, said Mr. Rubio's speech was very reassuring, but noted that in the administration, some have harsher tones on these topics. In her speech to the conference, she stressed that Europe must become more independent, including on defense. She insisted on Europe's digital sovereignty, its approach to hate speech on social media. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer said that we shouldn't get in the warm bath of complacency. He said the UK must reforge closer ties with Europe to help the continent stand on our own 2 feet in its own defense, and said there needs to be investment that moves us from overdependence to interdependence. Hanno Pevkur, the defense minister of the EU and NATO member Estonia, said it was quite a bold statement to say that America is a child of Europe. It was a good speech, needed here today, but that doesn't mean that we can rest on pillows now, he told the Associated Press. So still a lot of work has to be done. Secretary Rubio didn't mention Greenland. After last month's escalation over Mr. Trump's designs on the Arctic land, on the Arctic island, the U.S., Denmark, and Greenland started technical talks on an Arctic security deal. The Secretary of State met briefly in Munich on Friday with the Danish and Greenlandic leaders, a meeting Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen described as constructive. But Ms. Frederiksen suggested Saturday that although the dispute has cooled, she remains wary. Asked whether the crisis is past, she replied, "No, unfortunately not. I think the desire from the U.S. president is exactly the same. He is very serious about this theme." Asked whether she can put a price on Greenland, she said, "Of course not," adding that we have to respect sovereign states and we have to respect people's rights for self-determination. And the Greenlandic people have been very clear. They don't want to become Americans. And a note here, Associated Press reporter Geir Molson reported from Berlin, and writer James Keaton contributed from Geneva, and this particular article was by Matthew Lee, Emma Burrows, and Geir Molson, all of whom are with the Associated Press. Still in the USA section, our next headline reads, ICE official says officers appear to have lied regarding shooting of immigrant. The statement marks the latest in a string of federal immigration shootings where evidence has contradicted initial accounts. The date on this particular article is February the 14th. It is by Christian Martinez of Reuters. Two two federal officers appear to have lied about the events that led up to the shooting of a Venezuelan immigrant in Minneapolis last month. Todd Lyons, the acting U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement Director, said Friday. In a statement, Mr. Lyons said, a review of video footage by ICE and the Department of Justice has revealed that sworn testimony provided by two separate officers appears to have made untruthful statements. Both officers have been placed on administrative leave, and the U.S. Attorney's Office is investigating the false statements, Mr. Lyons said. Upon conclusion of the investigation, the officers may face termination of employment as well as potential criminal prosecution. The announcement comes a day after the Justice Department moved to drop charges against the Venezuelan immigrant, Julio Cesar Sosa Celis, who was shot in the leg, and another man accused of assaulting a federal officer. The top federal prosecutor in Minnesota, Daniel Rosen, asked a judge to dismiss the charges, writing, "Newly discovered evidence in this matter is materially inconsistent with the allegations." Mr. Rosen sought the dismissal with prejudice, which means the charges cannot be reintroduced. ICE and federal agents have faced strong pushback against their immigration enforcement surge in Minneapolis, during which two U.S. citizens have been killed. Earlier this week, President Donald Trump's border czar, Tom Homan, said the surge would be winding down. And a note here. Reuters reporter Christina Cook and editor Michelle Nichols contributed to this particular report, which was written by Christian Martinez, all of Reuters. Still in the USA section, our next headline reads, America at 250. What would Ben Franklin say? Reenactors aim to spark reflection. Reenactors portraying George Washington and Ben Franklin say America's 250th is a chance to tell the true, complex story of America's founding. The date on this article is February the 13th. It is by Scott Baldoff and Melanie Stetson Freeman. Scott is a staff writer at the Monitor, and Melanie is a staff photographer. The date line on this article is Williamsburg, Virginia. It's a sunny, wintry morning in January, and a man who bears a strong resemblance to Ben Franklin is walking the brick-lane sidewalks of Colonial Williamsburg. In a few months, the streets here will be teeming with tourists eager to meet with historical reenactors like this man, B.J. Pryor, and to learn more about the founding days of the American Republic as the United States celebrates the 200th anniversary of its independence. Some tourists may be curious about what America's founding fathers, or the closest approximation they can find, would have thought about American democracy today, even though interpreters of historical characters meticulously say stay true to their time period. But understanding the aspirations, the original intent of the founding fathers, might not be as simple as it seems. Everyone wants to claim the founding fathers and use them for their purposes, says Mr. Pryor, who has portrayed Franklin for two decades. As Franklin, I like to tell people, I'm glad we have approved this new constitution. I think it is the best we could possibly have obtained under the circumstances. And the most important thing about it is we can change it. Even Thomas Jefferson, Pryor notes, admitted that institutions must adapt to keep pace with the times. Christopher Brown, a historian on the Revolutionary War at Columbia University and consultant for the Ken Burns documentary series The American Revolution, says the men who put their signatures on the Declaration in 1776 agreed on the need to be free of monarchical rule and little else. I think they would be amused by the notion of original intent of the Founding Fathers, not least because the document that they created, the Constitution, was full of compromises, Professor Brown adds. There were so many intents in the room at the moment that document was written, it would be ridiculous to think there could be one legitimate intent. As divided as America feels today, there is a glimmer of hope in what Pryor and other historical reenactors encounter, the shared curiosity in learning more about the roots of America's experiment in democracy. To capture the essence of those times, Americans need to shake off their tendency to treat the Revolutionary War period as sacred, says Ted Maris Wolf, a historian and associate director of the Charles Center at the College of William and Mary. Americans today might recognize hot-button issues that confronted the nation builders of 1776. What does it mean that all men are created equal? What are the limits of individual freedom or of the federal government? But people also struggle to connect the dots between the challenges of America's revolutionary generation and today. Mr. Maris Wolf argues that historical reenactors can provide a citizen's guide to understanding America's foundation in order to map out its future. With these reenactors, there seems to be at least an attempt to make those political figures real human beings, says Mr. Maris Wolf, who was once the director of Colonial Williamsburg. You can show the vulnerabilities, the failures, in addition to the achievements, the founding of the country. Clad in the black woolen broadcloth jacket and breeches of an 18th-century gentleman, B.J. Pryor has been portraying Ben Franklin for decades, passing along insights from his personal research to visitors, schoolchildren, and tour groups. When he is dressed as Franklin, Mr. Pryor keeps his 21st-century opinions to himself. But if he is doing his job right, he can give his audience the tools to learn from Franklin's documented beliefs and actions to help people understand the principles on which the United States was founded. Whenever I hear a sentence that begins, "the founding fathers thought," I think, okay, that sentence is bogus because there is nothing that the founding fathers all thought the same about, or hardly anything, Mr. Pryor says. They disagreed, they fought, they bickered, they hated one another. Today, people might recognize the same thing amid political hyperpartisanship. Indeed, tension back then sparked armed conflicts between colonies. Connecticut and Pennsylvania fought not one but three wars over disputed territory along the Susquehanna River. Even when they were united against the British, some of the colonies were reluctant to give up sovereignty to a national government. Any document signed in these conditions was bound to be a work in progress. They did not think that they were drawing up a document that would last for 200 years, Mr. Pryor says, back at his modern townhouse, showing off his collection of books and magazines from the colonial period. You know, they assumed that this was a good system and it would work, but times would change, and no doubt something different would be needed down the road. In short, the founding fathers wrote a remarkable document that made independence appear not only possible, but also inevitable. Along with a constitution written a decade later, they built a foundation for a system of self-government that would continually need repairs and improvement. Today, some constitutional scholars say that document is under threat from a Trump administration that interprets it as giving broad powers to the head of the executive branch, a stance the U.S. Supreme Court has largely upheld. Mr. Pryor, drawing on his knowledge of the Founding Fathers, said they anticipated there would be conflict. The purpose of government cannot be to bring perfect harmony among all people, Mr. Pryor says. What you do hope a government can do is keep us from slitting one another's throats, enable us to share a polity without killing one another or inflicting gross harm on one another. If we can accomplish that, we have done something great. Dan Shipley's journey to portray George Washington began shortly after two jetliners struck the World Trade Center in 2001. Like many Americans, Mr. Shipley was shaken to his core by the event, but he noticed something more. Americans were questioning what it meant to be an American. We all come from diverse backgrounds, very diverse thoughts, says Mr. Shipley. If you take all the things we don't have in common, the one thing we have is the foundational ideas that go back to the Revolution. Ideas and values such as freedom, equality, and liberty are not static and can be in conflict with each other, says Mr. Maris Wolf at William & Mary. Education specialist at Colonial Williamsburg designed curricula to help students and the general public understand the tensions between values such as unity versus diversity, law versus ethics, private wealth versus commonwealth, and freedom versus equality, which fueled the Founding Fathers' debate on what it means to be American. There was no resolution at the time in the debates over these values, and there continues to be no resolution today, Mr. Maris Wolf says. People want to know what historical figures would say about today's issues, but it's not the same America now as then. For Mr. Shippey, the best way to teach about the American Revolutionary period was to make dusty historical figures come to life. A friend suggested that he portray George Washington. He said, "Well, you're tall and you've got the nose for the job," Shippey recalls. He portrayed Washington at Mount Vernon for 4 years and continues in other venues. With the 250th anniversary of independence, Mr. Shippey sees an opportunity to capitalize on American curiosity for the past. We are getting this moment to remind people of the importance of the founding ideals of America, Mr. Shippey said. These are the ideals that set the foundation of who we are and where we want to be. For the record, Barry Stevens never asked to become Ben Franklin. A retired theater teacher in Alexandria, Virginia, he started attending historical reenactments at the suggestion of his son back in 1999. He appreciated the theatrical element of men and women who portrayed Revolutionary War soldiers, artisans, and camp followers, and he found himself drawn in. Initially, he attended Revolutionary War reenactments, made period-appropriate clothes, and grew his hair out into a ponytail. Then, sometime around 2005, people started calling him Ben. "People would come up to me and they'd say, 'Hi, Ben, how are things in Philadelphia?'" Mr. Stevens says. "No sign, no name tag, nothing that I did to try and elicit that kind of a response. And after a while, I got to thinking, well, maybe there is something in this." Mr. Stevens threw himself into the role and recently portrayed Franklin in the 2025 docudrama The American Miracle alongside Mr. Shippey as Washington. Like most historical interpreters, Mr. Stevens enjoys interacting with Americans who have the curiosity to learn about their past, but he stays in character and avoids putting 21st century opinions into 18th century Ben's mouth. His Franklin has opinions about the Boston Tea Party, for instance. For the record, Franklin, as America's representative in London, viewed the Patriots' destruction of British tea as a dangerous provocation. But Mr. Stevens says he avoids getting dragged into more modern debates. "I can't say, oh, this White House is something else, because I have to limit my discussion to what I knew existed up until Franklin's death." But Mr. Stevens says he can reflect the fact that Franklin's views about trade relations, slavery, and the tensions between Western expansion and treaties with Native American tribes each changed dramatically over time until his death in 1790. "I feel an obligation to present the truth of it all," Mr. Stevens said, after a recent presentation to a gathering at a senior center in Alexandria. "You don't necessarily have to take a line and say, well, Franklin would have been against this or that. But it certainly can stir your thought and say that issue sounds familiar and we're still dealing with it, or it's coming back." In Portsmouth, New Hampshire, you can walk through a neighborhood once called Puddle Dock, now managed by the Strawberry Bank Museum. The street still feels part of the 18th century, full of role players dressed in revolutionary times. Nancy Dickinson, an Air Force veteran and former elementary school teacher, portrays Catherine Stavers, an 18th century tavern keeper at Strawberry Bank. Stavers built the tavern, Portsmouth's largest, in 1766 with her own money. Ms. Dickinson says she and her husband ran it. The question visitors ask... The question visitors ask can be quite sophisticated. Some people want to know more about the rights of women in 18th century America. Others ask about the differences between rich and poor people in America, or about the legacy of slavery and race. All three of these questions reverberate today, reflected in court fights over abortion, growing tensions over income inequality and issues of affordability, and the current administration's campaign against diversity, equity, and inclusion in higher education and in the workplace. We are modern people, and some people have difficult questions to ask, Ms. Dixon said. She has occasionally come out of character if people become emotional about a particular topic. I talk with them, and they feel more comfortable, Ms. Dickinson says. When she talks about slavery, this is something that people should know about. We can acknowledge that it is awful. We can't say it never happened. Ultimately, people who come to historical sites like Strawberry Bank are curious learners who also carry with them a lifetime of biases and experiences that shape how they view the world. The key is to build on that curiosity, Ms. Dickinson says, and to show that some of the challenges back then have not been resolved. As we get into 2026, the question is, how are we going to be talking about this period? Will it be just marching bands and speeches? And again, this particular article is by Scott Baldoff, who is a staff writer at the Monitor, and Melody Stetson Freeman, who is a staff photographer at the Monitor. And with that, we're going to move quickly over to the commentary section and pick up an editorial. And this one, the headline reads, "Chatting with Ben about his and our challenges. Americans are grappling with an onslaught of issues that call into question just what holds us together as a nation. The nation's founders have some advice." The date on this is February 17th, and it is by Scott Baldoff, who was one of the two writers of our previous article. It's not every day that a reporter gets an email from Ben Franklin. In the course of reporting a story on historical reenactors from the American Revolutionary War period, I was in regular email contact with two Ben Franklins, one George Washington, and an 18th century tavern owner from the British colony of New Hampshire. One of the Bens invited me to read his Substack column. It reads exactly like Ben Franklin would have written it if he did, in fact, live in a society that had capitalized on the newly discovered energy source of electricity, taken a magical carriage ride through the industrial age to the computer age, and ditched typeset printing tools for digital publishing. Why would a Monitor reporter do any of this? The answer is right there in the headlines we read or avoid reading every day. Americans are grappling with an onslaught of issues that call into question just what holds us together as a nation, and they're doing this at the very moment the country is preparing to celebrate the 250th year of its independence. Taking a look at the issues that American founders who met in Philadelphia to argue, negotiate, compromise, and finally write the Declaration of Independence offers a chance to see how far America has come as a democracy and how far it has yet to go. Many of the issues that beset us today also seemed insolvable in 1776, so the Founding Fathers did what anyone would do. They did the best they could, cobbled together the best solution they could, and moved on to the next issue. As Americans debate modern problems of immigration, taxation, foreign policy, or personal choice, it is reasonable to question what the Founders would have done. More than one of the historians I talked with quoted Thomas Jefferson. "I am certainly not an advocate for frequent and untried changes in laws and constitutions, but I know also the laws and institutions must go hand in hand with the progress of the human mind. We might as well require a man to wear still the coat which fitted him when a boy as civilized society to remain ever under the regime of their barbarous ancestors. We hope you find this brief step back into the 18th century useful in understanding the origins of the 21st century world we live in today." And again, that particular commentary was by Scott Baldoff, who is a staff writer at the Monitor. All right, we're going to go over to the book section of today's Monitor, and just we have enough time to fit in a couple more of the best books for the month of January. So this fiction. The title of the book is This is Where the Serpent Lives by Danielle Mouin Newton. Danielle Mouin Newton examines privilege and poverty amid Pakistan's caste system. The novel begins in the 1950s with an orphan boy surviving on the street and unfolding to the present day, exposing the chasm between classes. And that little review is by Joan Gaylord. And here are some nonfiction titles our reviewers liked. Winter, The Story of a Season by Val McDaniel. Val McDaniel, best known for her intricately plotted tartan noir crime novels, takes the sting out of the short frosty days and long wind-blown nights in this lovely, gentle, beautifully illustrated paean to the darkest season in her native Scotland. And that's just a taste on that one. The Oak and the Larch by Sophie Pinkham. The forest was Russia's birthplace, but in its quest for empire, the forest that had protected it from invasions became targets. Pinkham's focus is on how Russian literature and cinema have long spurred resistance to the various governments' heedlessness of environmental consequences. How about Always Carry Salt by Samantha Ellis? Samantha Ellis's memoir explores the complexity of reacquainting with her ancestral tongue, Judeo-Iraqi Arabic, brimming with historical accounts, family anecdotes, and enticing recipes. Hello, Makbush. The book captivates. There's searching and much stretching as Ellis finds her way through a rich tangle of stories, personal, political, cultural, and linguistic. And how about, and with that, I'm afraid we have run out of time for today. As always, I appreciate you taking some time out of your day to listen to a variety of articles from the Christian Science Monitor with me. Stay safe, stay well, and stay hopeful. I'll be back with more from the Monitor at the end of this week. Thank you for listening.